फलं तेषां
फलं तेषां
that one who worships a demigod can reach the Supreme Lord. But here it is clearly stated that the worshippers of demigods go to the different planetary systems where various demigods are situated. Just as a worshipper of the sun achieves the sun, or a worshipper of the demigod of the moon achieves the moon. Similarly, if anyone wants to worship a demigod like Indra, he can attain that particular god's planet. It is not that everyone, regardless of whatever demigod is worshipped, will reach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is denied. denied here, for it is clearly stated that the worshippers of demigods go to different planets in the material world, but the devotee of the Supreme Lord goes directly to the supreme planet of the personality of Godhead.
Om jnana jnana tasya jnanjana shalakaya chakshur viditam jnana tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manoyasam sthapitam jnana bhutale sayam rupadam jnana rati shapasantikam vande yamakasi guru shri vithapada kamalam shri
are controlled by a person. If you throw a rock in the water, the fish may think, okay, now there's going to be a high pressure area, there's going to be a low pressure area. But behind that, there's a person who's thrown the rock into water. The fish may not see you, but we know you're there. So the cosmic manifestation is going on that way also. And the controllers of the different departments are called devas. And some of them have been mentioned by Srila Prabhupada here. The Vibhishan, who's mentioned earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, is the sun god. Chandra is there as the moon god. And these are actual persons, just as Obama is not a mythological person. The Vibhishan is not a mythological person. Both of them are real. And Krishna says, I spoke this Bhagavad Gita long ago to Vibhishan, the sun god. He spoke it to his son, Manu. And Manu spoke it to his son, Ikshaku. And in that way, it's been coming down in the Guru Brahmapra system for a long, long time. So everything here is personal, and everything here is real. The demigods are not simply symbolic any more than the Secretary of State or the State Secretary of the Treasury or Secretary of Defense is symbolic. They're all persons with responsibilities, power, portfolios. So these different demigods are powerful persons who've been given portfolios in the management of material nature. This is God's way of doing things. He doesn't have to do everything personally. Any big executive delegates responsibilities. So that begins with the supreme executive, Krishna. He delegates responsibilities to sun god, moon god, Indra, and others. So these demigods have their worshippers, just as there are worshippers of the big men in the material world. In any state, there are always those who suck up to the powerful persons. They flatter or ingratiate themselves with whoever's in power, especially if you're in the transportation industry, then you try to ingratiate yourself with the officials in the transportation department. If you're in some of the agriculture business, then you try to ingratiate yourself with the agricultural officials. This is how it goes on in the material world. We do these sort of things to get ahead with our business. So there are people also who worship various devas to get ahead with their program. In Vrindavan, Krishna found that his father was planning a big sacrifice to worship Indra. And his father explained, well, we're living by agriculture. We depend on the clouds and rains. Indra is in charge of the clouds and rains, so we're worshiping Indra. Perfectly natural. The people who want different things are recommended in different Vedic texts to worship different gods. In the Shastra it said, Arogyam Paskaram Ijyet. If you want freedom from disease, if you want good health, then worship the sun god. This was told to me actually by there's one sun temple in northern Orissa, not far from Konark. There's the famous temple of the sun in Konark, but there's another one. And we happened to go there, and we met the pujari, who is a very healthy looking man with a bright sunny face and shining. And he said, he quoted this, that if you want freedom from disease, worship the sun. And we even see that people who may not believe in the Vedic literature nonetheless go out into the sun to get the healthy rays and be free from disease. So this idea is there for a good husband. One may worship Lord Shiva. For this, one worships that. there's a long list in the Vedic literature. People worship very often Ganesh for freedom from obstacles and very often for material prosperity. In Maharashtra especially, the worship of Ganesh is very popular. And there's a lot of different worship of different gods that people perform to have happiness in this world. And Krishna says that ultimately the worshippers of these different gods can go to the abodes of these different gods. People are still interested in going to the moon, although the money these days seems to be dedicated to Mars. I don't know if the Mars program has been cut back a little bit during the recession, whether you become less interested in Mars and more interested in places closer to home. But anyway, the idea is to go to Mars or go to the moon by space vehicles. But Krishna says, if you want to go, there's a less expensive and more effective way. You can go by worshiping the person in charge. Because you're going to have to go anyway. That is to say, you're going to have to leave here anyway. At the time of death, no one can say, I'm staying here, thank you very much. I like it. I'm happy. I'm situated. I have people who love me, and I love them. And I have responsibilities. They're depending on me. And thank you, but I'll stay. That option is not available. One has to leave. And Krishna says that if you've been worshiping one of these demigods, then you can go to the demigods. It's implied here that all of the demigods are different, and they all have their particular plans. The same thing is said elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita, Yanti Deva Bhuta Devam Vitri Yanti Vitri Bhuta Bhutani Yanti Bhute Ja Yanti Ma Yanti Ma Yajan Opima. If you worship the demigods, you go to the demigods. If you worship the Pitris, you go to the Pitris. If you worship the ghosts, you can go to the ghosts. And if you worship me, you can come to me. So the individual, it's not that it's all one. Each demigod is an individual. Each demigod has his planet. By following the road to your house, you don't come to my house. By following the road to his house, you don't come to your house. Every place is different. Every place has its own atmosphere. The moon and the sun are not the same. The sun and Venus are not the same. Venus and Mars are not the same. Anything and everything else are different. And by worshiping a particular demigod, one goes to that particular god's planet. There are those, Prabhupada mentions, who think that whoever you worship, you go to the same place. But that's not accepted here. That's not accepted here. The idea behind that seems to be that since these are all representatives of God, they're all symbols of God. God is something higher. God is something formless and nameless and shapeless and indistinct. So whichever of these manifest symbols you choose, you'll go to the same location. But that's not accepted in Bhagavad Gita. These demigods are not simply symbolic any more than this Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or this Secretary of the Treasury is symbolic. They're actual people with actual responsibilities, and they're each different. By bribing the Secretary of Transportation, you don't get ahead in the agricultural activities. You have to bribe the Secretary of Agriculture. Nobody works in that way. Bribe or satisfy. Yes. Here the point may be raised that if the demigods are different parts of the body of the Supreme Lord, then the same end should be achieved by worshiping them. However, worshippers of the demigods are less intelligent because they don't know what part of the body food must go to. what part of the body food must be supplied. Some of them are so foolish that they claim that there are many parts and many ways to supply food. This isn't very sanguine. Can anyone supply food to the body through the ears or eyes? They don't know that the demigods are different parts of the universal body of the Supreme Lord, and in their ignorance, they believe that each and every demigod is a separate god and a competitor of the Supreme Lord. When I first joined the society back in 1968 at 26 Second Avenue in New York, there was one very nice girl who was coming. There were several yoga societies that were popular at that time, and the people from the yoga societies were very nice people. They cherished the idea of oneness, and they cherished the idea that really everyone is on the same path and they're all going to the same place, and they had this they were cultivating peace, and they were cultivating love, and they were cultivating the sense that we're all on the same journey. And so there was one girl who belonged to such a yoga society, but was coming regularly for our kirtans and classes at 26 Second Avenue. And she was a very nice girl, very sweet, very loving. And when Prabhupada came to New York, she naturally came to his classes. And after one of his lectures, when he called for questions, she spoke up, and in a very sort of in a way, as if to give Srila Prabhupada an opportunity to expound on the topic, she very, in a sort of knowing voice, she said, "Swamiji, isn't it true that ultimately everything is one?" And Srila Prabhupada said no. He said, just as if you want to put food in the body, he said, can you put it here? Or here? He said, there are 9 holes in the body. Can you put the food here? Or here? Or here? He said, no, you have to put the food in the mouth so that it goes to the stomach. So it's not that everything is one, everything is distinct, everything is individual. You have to know where to put the food. If you put it in your ear, you don't get the same result. And you have to put the food in the mouth. And Prabhupada further expounded on the subject. I think she was very, as I remember, somehow or other, oneness was not doing so well that day. Anyway, the idea is unsophisticated or childish or just doesn't hold up to scrutiny, that everything is the same, so wherever you put your energy, wherever you put your money, it's the same. There's an old story about the person who was taking all of his money and depositing it in the bank. And then when he retired, went to withdraw his money and was told that he had no money. And it was discovered that all this time he'd been putting the money in someone else's account. And therefore he was bankrupt. So here also, there's a distinction between placing our money, our energy, in that which is eternal and that which is temporary. Nasato vidite pavo pavo vidite sataha upayor vidrishvan tas tvanyas tatvadarshi. The tatvadarshis, the seers of the truth, have analyzed and noted the difference between that which always exists and that which practically never exists, that is, which exists only temporarily, like a dream. A dream exists, but it disappears. So it's as if it doesn't exist, because it has no purpose. permanent existence. So here also, antabhattu palam kesham, phala means fruit, that which we get, that which we're working for. But antabhat means it has an end. Just like this body, antabhantayine deha, netyas yogda shariva. The soul within the body is eternal, but the body itself is temporal. In a similar way, there are fruits that are temporary. Sense gratification is temporary. Krishna says the happiness that comes from gratification of the senses has a beginning and an end to it. And therefore, an intelligent person doesn't take pleasure in that sort of happiness. It comes and goes. The intelligent person takes pleasure in eternal source of happiness. So here it said that by worshipping the demigods, one may get some fruit, some result, but antava, it will come to an end, it will be temporary. Antavanta, antavaktu palantesham, tadbhavati, alpamedhas. And therefore, the same thing, Krishna says that one who's after that fruit, or one who's worshipping the gross devas, is alpamedhas. Alpa medhasa. Alpa means small, and medhasa, intelligence. The persons of less intelligence worship the demigods, anyadevata, for getting some fruit, which after all is going to come to an end. Tadbhavati alpa medhasa. Devan devayajo yanti. By worshipping the devas, they'll go to the devas. But madbhakta yanti mamati. My devotees, Krishna says, will come to me. Tathama padamamama. They'll come to my supreme abode. Not only are demigods part of the Supreme Lord, but ordinary living entities are also. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated that the brahmanas are the head of the Supreme Lord. The kshatriyas are his arms, the vaishyas are his waist, the shudras are his legs, and all serve different functions. Regardless of the situation, if one knows that both the demigods and himself are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, his knowledge is perfect. But if he does not understand this, he achieves different planets where the demigods reside. This is not the same destination the devotees achieve. It's stated in several places in the Vedic literature that all living entities are part of the universal body of the Lord and all have their part to play. The intelligent men or the Brahmins, the administrative section or the Kshatriyas, the merchants, farmers, the Vaishyas, and the ordinary workers, the shudras, are all different. You can't take a shudra and make him an intellectual just by putting him in a university. Similarly, just that you take a university professor and make him a street sweeper doesn't mean that he stops thinking. He'll still be thinking of intellectual topics. The Brahmin may not be very good at making money, at business and corporate affairs. Everyone has a distinct ability. All right, you can maybe get this person to do something a little different. You can use a chisel for a screwdriver. You can walk on your hands if you have to. But generally, we walk with our feet, we grasp with our hands, we think with our head. You can carry something on your head also, or you can use different parts of the body for different things, but they have their natural function. And when we use the natural part for the natural function, things work well. So society also needs to be arranged in such a way that everyone is suitably engaged, not according to his birth, but according to his capabilities and the work that he actually does. And according to that system, one should be engaged. engaged in the service of the Lord. That's the ultimate point. Whether things are properly divided, not properly divided, unless we're engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we're wasting our time. And on the other hand, if we perform our duties for the satisfaction of the Lord, then it doesn't matter whether we're in the intellectual section or the business sector or the serving sector. Everyone can attain perfection. Yatav pravittir bhutanam yena sarvabhidhaktatam svakarmanatam abhyarchasiddhim. A human being can become perfect, whatever his occupation, by being engaged in the service of Krishna. The results achieved by the demigods' benedictions are perishable, because within this material world, the planets, the demigods, and their worshippers are all perishable. If you go to the moon, it's great, but you can't stay there because the moon is going to die eventually. All of these planets are going to perish. So where is the question of permanence? Therefore, it is clearly stated in this verse that all results achieved by worshipping demigods are perishable, and therefore such worship is performed by the less intelligent living entity. Because the pure devotee engaged in Krishna consciousness, in devotional service of the Supreme Lord, achieves eternal blissful existence that is full of knowledge, his achievements and those of the common worshipper of the demigods are different. The Supreme Lord is unlimited. His favor is unlimited. His mercy is unlimited. Therefore, the mercy of the Supreme Lord upon his pure devotees is unlimited. Therefore, the intelligent person will engage in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Lord. Lord Chaitanya said that in this age, or the Sri Srimad Bhagavatam says that in this age, the intelligent persons will join in the Sankirtan movement. Krishna Varnam Prashad Krishna Sangopan Gastra Parshadam Yajyai Sankirtanaya Prayer Vijantihi Sumedasa. As there's Alpamedasa, small intelligence, there's also Sumedasa, very good intelligence. And the Bhagavatam says that in Kali Yuga, those who have very good intelligence will engage in the Sankirtan Yajna, or the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Mukta Sangha Padam Yuga. In this way, one will be freed from all material existence and go back home, back to Godhead. Are there some questions? Comments?
Do you really believe that on the sun there's somebody living there?
Why not?
It's pretty hot.
Do you really think that there are people living in Mexico?
Yeah.
You go up and do an interview in Alaska. Excuse me, do you believe that there are actually people living in Mexico? Not possible. Still trying to decide whether there's people living in Northern California. It's too hot there. We have this idea that living beings, what is that? They're looking for life as we know it. Life as we know it. We assume that if there's life, it must be something like what we know here. There must be, they're looking in this other place. Is there nitrogen? Is there hydrogen? Is there carbon? Is there this? Is there, because life as we know it involves nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon, and so on. But that doesn't mean life everywhere is like that. It's like in certain parts of Florida, life as we know it means mobile homes. And if the situation is unsuitable for mobile homes, well, then people can't live there. But it's not that there must be no mobile homes. In other parts, they live in tents. How can people live in New York City? You are no camels. How could people live? So we have this idea that life has to be something as we know it, but we see, practically speaking, that in this world, life is everywhere. A year or so back, I went with a tour of young people, and we visited Carlsbad Caverns. Where is that, New Mexico or something?
Yeah.
New Mexico. And you go down the elevator so many feet deep into the earth, and they illuminate it just very gently, so it's not entirely dark, but it's spooky. But otherwise, it would be pitch black. And there are creatures living there. There are fish with no eyes, and there are various kinds of insects, and of course the bats live there. There are creatures who live in this place where, as far as you and I are concerned, it would be absolutely unlivable. It's cold out there, too. Cold, dark, unsuitable for life. Grass can't grow there. And yet there are creatures adapted to that environment. I saw some item that they drilled down into the glaciers up in the Arctic region and went down for however far they could go down. And deep below the glaciers, they found little primitive algae. That means living beings, living happily, as far as we know, under the glacier. And you and I can't live any place near that. Sandwiched underneath so many levels of ice. But they're living. Similarly, we couldn't live in the water. We make some arrangement, we stay there, you know, maybe for a few hours. But there are living beings who are perfectly happy living in the water. And even there are those who live in fresh water, and there are those who live in salt water. The saltwater fish can't imagine how you could live without salt in the water. And the freshwater fish think, how could those guys live over there with all that salt? But both fish are living very happily in their own environment. And then there are the creatures that live in the tropical environments, and there are creatures that live in the air, there are creatures that live in the earth, there are creatures that live everywhere we go. So they have bodies adapted to a particular environment. Our bodies, even, you know, like a Western body, we can live in India, but we have to adapt a little bit. We have to make sure we've got our sunscreen, and we have to be a little bit careful because that white skin can get cancer from the sun, whereas the local people don't have a problem of that nature because their bodies are made for that environment. So everybody has got a particular construction suited to the particular environment in which it's meant to live. So we understand from Bhagavad Gita, from Vedic knowledge, that it's not that all over the world it's like that, and as soon as you go to some other world, empty. Even if you look between a crack, you look in a crack in the sidewalk, and somebody lives there, somebody's growing there. And every whole world is inhabited. But every place else in the universe is just empty space. No, that's not the picture from the Vedic knowledge. There are living beings there, but they're living according to the particular atmosphere. And planets like the moon and the sun, these are higher planets, so they have more subtle bodies, they have more sophisticated bodily construction. They have higher powers, they have longer lifetimes. So the idea that we're just going to go there by jet propulsion is a little dodgy. And the idea that they're just empty is not accepted in Vedic knowledge. Some other questions?
That's right. He says here that therefore the mercy of the Supreme Lord upon his pure devotees is unlimited.
Mm.
Is the mercy of the Lord's pure devotees also unlimited?
Yes. Because the pure devotee of the Lord can give you Krishna's mercy. apart from that, the devotees can be more merciful than the Lord. The Lord may be a little strict, but the devotee can be more liberal. So if the devotee prays to the Lord, and dear Lord, please accept this person in your service, the Lord becomes more inclined. Just as we see this in history, sometimes the someone is trying to get government favor, or someone is trying to get mercy from the government, and the king is inflexible. No, but his daughter comes, please, 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 and just to satisfy the daughter, the king says, "All right, let him go. All right, give him whatever it is." Out of affection for the daughter, the king gives his mercy to the whoever it is. So Krishna also, when the devotee is pleased, then the Lord also becomes favorably inclined. Something else?
Sometimes we say first deserve, then desire.
Mm.
But then how does mercy come in? If you're deserving, then that's just karma. It's owed to you.
Mercy means you get it even though you don't deserve. That's mercy. Otherwise, it's just getting your due. When the king says, "Okay, I award you this because that's the law," that's just normal state of affairs. But when the king says, "You don't deserve it, but I'm giving it to you," that's mercy.
But we're told we should try to get the mercy. So
that's all right. You can decide it.
But then, is there a technique how to get mercy?
By service.
Then it becomes a business. I'm working because I want mercy. So if I don't get the mercy, I may later on stop.
Yeah, that's called conditional service. I'll serve you, maybe kind of with one eye open, you know, looking to see whether I'm going to get rewarded. And if I don't get rewarded, then after a while I'll say, well, you know, I'll come and I'll say, I just want to do whatever you want. I just want to make you happy, whatever it is. I'm your surrendered servant. And then I stick with you for a while. But I've always got an eye open watching to see whether there's some return. And after a while, if there's no return, I say, well, you know, I am your servant, but I've got something to do in Chicago, and if you don't mind, it's been nice to know you. That's business. But and of course, one may begin that way, a little business-minded, but then think that, why should I be business-minded? I just like this servant. That's the general pattern. Just like Guru Maharaj, he had some material motive to get a kingdom. But then he became so satisfied by the service that he didn't want anything. So even if we start with some motive, we may become more attracted by the service itself. Generally it's like that. We approach God with some motive in mind. So that's mixed devotion. We're partly attracted to God and partly attracted to what God can give us. But the pure devotee doesn't care what he gets, he just wants to serve. That's the advanced stage. Something else? Yes?
Could you explain destiny in this context?
Could I explain destiny in this context? Well, that's an easy thing to do. Explain destiny. Well, destiny means the results of your own activities. If you put your hand in the fire, it's destined that you'll get burned. If you invested in junk loans, then it's destined that later on things will collapse and you'll lose your money. So many things. You do X, then you'll get result Y. So, in that sense, Prabhupada used to say that man is the architect of his own fortune. Our karma means
the results of our previous activities. We've already done so many things for so many lifetimes, and therefore there's some result which is to be expected by the laws of nature, and that's destiny. But the mercy of the Lord can transcend destiny, that although something is destined, your destiny changes by the mercy of the Lord. Karmani nirdhati kintu prapartibhata. The stock of karma is burned up by the mercy of the Lord. So our destiny can change.
In reincarnation, do we go to Krishna? Can we ever stay there, or do we always get reincarnated?
In reincarnation, can we go to Krishna and stay there, or do we always come back and get reincarnated? Yes. By reincarnation, generally we come back and back and back and back. But when one goes to Krishna, yagatva nani vartante, Krishna says, you never come back.
Yeah.
You never come back. That's eternal.
What makes that happen then?
What makes that happen?
Yeah.
That you devote yourself to Krishna, so that when you leave this body, instead of going to this place or that place or another place for another body, you get a spiritual body in the spiritual world with Krishna, and you stay there
forever.
Because two things decide or determine. One is your desire, and the other is what you deserve. So if you desire to be with Krishna, then you can always stay with Krishna.
So I've come back just because I never realized him before?
Yeah, we come back because we're not interested in Krishna. We go to this place or that place or the other place. We stay circulating in the cycle of birth and death because we're not so interested in Krishna. Those who are not so interested in Krishna, they don't achieve Krishna. They continue on the path of birth and death.
Until they find.
Yeah, we're not interested in going. You don't go to Rome until you have an interest in going to Rome. You stay in America, but if you develop an intense desire to go to Rome, and you make friends with people from Italy, and you save up your money, and you get to know the plane arrangements and all that, you can go. So one can go back to Krishna, but if you're not interested, how will you go? If you're more interested in the material world, how to become president, or how to become governor, or how to become an army lieutenant, or how to become
a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get another chance.
You come back again and again and again. Follow your material interests. But if you have an interest in Krishna, and you cultivate that interest, so that it becomes the goal of your life, and at the end of your life you're thinking of Krishna,
Maharaj, so this, as Maharaj is speaking about deserve and desire, do they kind of have some hand in hand? I mean, can someone desire to go to Krishna without deserving to go to Krishna? And therefore go?
You can desire and not deserve, but if you desire, then you'll think, well, I want to go, what do I have to do? I want to go to Italy, but I have only $200 and it costs $500. Please put the camera away. Please put your camera away. I want to go to Italy, but it costs $500 and I only have $200. Then you'll start thinking about, well, where can I find $300? And you'll start doing the things you need to do to go. So if someone's serious about going to Krishna, they start to think, well, what do I have to do to go to Krishna? Mm-hmm. And then the Vedic literature steps in and says, well, here's what you have to do. Or the spiritual master comes in. Guys, here's what you have to do. Chant Hare Krishna, think of Krishna. Think of me, become my devotee, worship me, offer your namaskar to me, and then you come to me. So the desire becomes the cause of our acting in such a way that we can deserve to go.
I have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
When we pray to like the thing behind the curtain, is that the symbol for Krishna?
Is the thing behind the curtain the symbol for Krishna? The murti, or the form,
that a symbol for Krishna? Some people think so, but according to the Vedic literature, the form of Krishna is not different from Krishna. Just like the name, we're chanting Hare Krishna. So generally, names or sounds are symbols, like the name tape, the name recorder is different from this thing here. It indicates that, but it's not the same. It's not that if this is sitting here and I'm in the next county and I say recorder, 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 the recorder is there. Because the word recorder is only a symbol for the thing, recorder. But on the spiritual platform, the thing and the symbol for the thing are the same. The sound, Krishna, and Krishna himself are identical. So by chanting Hare Krishna, you get all the benefit that you get from being with Krishna personally, because the sound is absolute. So the form is the same way. Our form is not absolute. You know, if you call, you see a picture of me, it's not that I'm here. I have to actually be here. If you throw darts at my picture, well, sorry, it doesn't work. You have to find me first and then throw the darts. The form and the person are the same, are different. But on the spiritual platform, the absolute platform, the form and the person are the same. So Krishna and Krishna's form are identical. Dehi deha, videho yam, vidyate nishre kuchet. There's no difference at all between Krishna and Krishna's form. So the form we see here is also the form of Krishna. Why is it the form of Krishna? Because it's fashioned according to the description of Krishna, even in Vedic literature. And even the elements of which it's fashioned, you say, well, it's just made of stone, or it's just made of wood. But that stone and wood are also Krishna, because there's it's Krishna's energy. But fashioned in such a way that Krishna is seen, Krishna is present. Is that okay?
So you believe that Krishna is really there?
You believe it's not there? It's only him. If God is omnipresent, then why is he not behind? He's everywhere except behind the curtain. Why is that?
Does the same apply to the devotees of the Lord? For example, is the form of Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada somewhat interlinked in a spiritual sense?
Is the form of Srila Prabhupada and the murti the same as Srila Prabhupada? Prabhupada answered that one time by saying, if you think of me, then I'm there. If you think of me, then I'm there. With my consciousness. Some other question?
This is my personal feeling. I like to go as far as possible and do complete devotion and all. But the conviction part, as Maharaj has mentioned, behind pattern, Krishna is really Krishna there. The conviction, how do you really get there?
Like by practice and by association. How do you get conviction? By practice and by the association of those who are convinced. If you associate with those who are nasty, those who say, ah, you really believe that stuff? I mean, come on, you were born yesterday or something? You really believe that there, you know, that there's God? I mean, come on. If those are the people with whom you spend your life, you'll wind up thinking, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you know, what kind of guy? That would be stupid.
You did that well.
I had a lot of practice. But if you associate with those who are devotees, who are convinced about Krishna consciousness, then by that convinced association, we also become convinced.
That's practical. Prabhupada came. What did we know?
What did we know about Krishna? But Prabhupada had such strong conviction about Krishna consciousness, and backed up also with evidence, with logic, with a practical experience. So then we became also convinced.
I have one more question. How does one become a Maharaja? Go about.
Excuse me? Well, how does one become a Maharaja? What do you mean by a Maharaja?
By the guru, by somebody to...
Guru means teacher. And you become a teacher by becoming a student. Today's student is tomorrow's teacher.
Interesting.
You should become a guru.
I wish to be one.
Yes. We wish you to be one.
Yes.
Why you? Everyone should become guru. Prabhupada had that, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had that desire. Everyone should become guru. There's a need of gurus. How do you become guru? First one, becomes a student.
Bhagavad Gita? Like
yes, you study Bhagavad Gita, but studying doesn't mean you study as your own teacher. Under the guidance, you find a qualified teacher, and under the guidance of your teacher, you study Bhagavad Gita, and then you become the next teacher.
You need the teacher to officially make you like a guru?
Yeah, it's not just official, but it's practical. Really want to understand Vigyan, if you really want to understand, not just theoretically, but practically. It's like if you want to be a surgeon, you don't just go read the surgery book. Right? You need a surgeon who's going to teach you how to do it. Then you can be the next surgeon. So in the same way, to be a guru, one takes guidance from a guru and studies the books like Bhagavad Gita under his guidance, under his direction, and then you become the next guru. And then your students become the next gurus. And it keeps going like that.
Hate to leave, but it's just
sounds like a good next book.
I'd like to swallow my eyes.